Welcome to episode 13 of our podcast series. This episode features material from our October 2024 print edition of the Future Leaders Communique. I'm Professor Joseph Ibrahim, the series editor, and welcome our guest editor for this episode, Dr. Erica Musgrove, a doctor in training at Alice Springs Hospital. Erica, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, this podcast episode, and your motivation for this work? I'm particularly interested because you've presented a compelling edition highlighting some of the challenges of providing patient care in rural and remote settings.
Thanks, Joe. I'm a current rural generalist trainee with the Australian College of Rural and Remote Medicine, or otherwise known as ACRM, and I'm currently working in Alice Springs in the Northern Territory. Like many of my peers, I am a country girl at heart, having grown up in rural Victoria, and I think that's really shaped the idea of what kind of medicine I want to practice and where I want to be in the future. And actually, despite knowing that I wanted to do rural generalist medicine in medical school, I actually spent the first 2 years of my training in a major metropolitan hospital in Melbourne. And whilst working there, I really observed in some of my colleagues a real sense of dread or fear when they were sent on rural secondments. People generally tried to avoid them, and when they went, they felt quite fearful about what they might face, about the supports they may or may not have in a rural setting. And that really got me thinking about, you know, what are the opportunities in rural medicine for junior doctors? Even if you don't want to work rurally long term, I think everyone can benefit from spending a little bit of time in a rural centre. I think, first of all, working with limited resources can actually be really good for honing your clinical acumen. Sometimes you can't get those test results back straight away. Sometimes you might only have an x-ray or no pathology overnight, and you do have to really focus on the patient in front of you and use that to make your assessment. So I think in that regard, it can really hone your clinical reasoning skills. And then secondarily, I think for junior doctors, no matter what specialty you want to do or where you want to work, having some kind of appreciation of what a rural setting might look like, what kind of resources or limitations the clinicians working there might have, is going to make you a lot more helpful and a lot more collaborative when you might be the specialist being called for assistance in your city hospital. So with that in mind, even though this case obviously does emphasise some of the challenges of rural medicine and how things can go wrong when the systems fall apart, I really would encourage the reader to try and look for the opportunities within rural medicine and how we can all work together better in the future and hopefully take some valuable lessons away from this case. And lastly, I just wanted to say thank you very much to the Communique's team for all your support and guidance with this edition. It has been a long time coming, but I'm really proud of the work that we've done, and I hope that readers and listeners enjoy. Thank you. This podcast presents a case from rural Australia where a culmination of missed opportunities and systemic issues resulted in a poor patient outcome during an inter-hospital transfer. Our expert commentators are Dr. Simon Judkins, an emergency physician and the past president of the Australasian College for Emergency Medicine, and Dr. Bridget Honan, who is also an emergency physician working in Grafton Hospital on Bundjalung Country and with the Central Australian Retrieval Service in Imbantwa, Alice Springs. Our narrator is Ashley Redman, a practicing registered nurse and actor. Let's now listen to the editorials.
Contents of this podcast. Guest editorial by Dr. Erica Musgrove. Editorial by Professor Joseph Ibrahim. Case: Midnight in the Outback by Dr. Erica Musgrove. Expert commentary. 1. Navigating Systems and Pathways by Dr. Simon Judkins. Expert Commentary 2. A Junior Doctor's Guide to Retrieval by Dr. Bridget Honan. Comments from our peers. Guest Editorial by Dr. Erica Musgrove. Growing up in rural Australia, healthcare for my community looked very different to what I would later encounter when working as a doctor in training in a major Australian city. My hometown has a 6 to 8 week wait for an appointment with a general practitioner, even for urgent issues, due to the shortage of general practitioners. For my grandparents, healthcare involves them making a 1,200 kilometre round trip, which takes about 12 hours driving, or a 1.5 hour flight each way, about once a month to see their various specialists in the nearest city. Where I currently work in Alice Springs, both our nearest referral hospitals are 1,500 kilometres away, Darwin and Adelaide. Even in the most urgent of transfers, it takes about 6 hours to get the patient to the receiving hospital. The way medical care occurs in rural and remote Australia is significantly different from the city centres. Often, rural doctors are working with resource constraints, including limited access to laboratory and imaging investigations, diagnostic and therapeutic procedures, specialist advice, and sometimes with very limited staff, well below what is recommended for a normal resuscitation. Moreover, rural doctors must have a broader, generalist skill set and scope of practice to best serve their communities. Naturally, there are limitations to what a rural practitioner can reasonably and safely know and practice. Sometimes the care or investigations a patient needs can only be found in a specialist metropolitan, tertiary, or quaternary centre. In these circumstances, transferring patients to such a centre is usually the most appropriate course, but does bring about a number of significant challenges. In this edition of the Future Leaders Communique, we explore a case from rural Queensland where a culmination of missed opportunities and systemic issues resulted in a poor patient outcome during a transfer. Although it is easy to focus on the negatives of rural medicine through this case, I would challenge the reader and my fellow junior doctors to look for the opportunities and learnings that rural medicine can provide us. For example, due to limited access to investigations, rural medicine often places a greater emphasis on strong clinical acumen and judgment. Just a few key pieces of information can alert an astute junior doctor to an unwell patient with the potential for a rapid clinical deterioration. This case also raises questions about how rural doctors can learn to safely manage specialised medical devices, and when and how to ask for help with such devices. Lastly, the role of the surgical registrar in the case underlines the importance of doctors who are receiving referrals in tertiary centres, having an appreciation of the context of rural environments, and doing their best to facilitate efficient communication and arrangements for transfers. Despite the systems issues that unfortunately do exist in rural medicine, clinical experience in a rural setting is an excellent opportunity for junior doctors to refine their clinical acumen, diagnostic reasoning, and management skills. Moreover, working rurally allows junior doctors to develop an appreciation for the many contexts in which medicine occurs in Australia. This allows us all to collaborate better when working together to coordinate patient care across vast distances. I am incredibly grateful to the expert commentators in this edition for their insights and perspectives on this case. Dr. Simon Judkins is an emergency physician and the past president of the Australasian College for Emergency Medicine. He has worked in metropolitan and rural emergency departments and is currently the director of emergency medicine in Echuca, rural Victoria. Dr. Bridget Honan is an emergency physician working in Grafton Hospital, a rural ED in beautiful Bundjalung country, and an occasional retrievalist with the amazing Central Australian Retrieval Service in Umbantua, Alice Springs. Editorial by Professor Joseph Ibrahim. Welcome to this edition of the Future Leaders Communique. The edition is tragic, fascinating, and illuminating. It jolted long-suppressed memories of my time as a junior medical officer when we did not have structured retrieval systems or dedicated teams. We had to ring around to every large hospital hoping to find someone kind enough or that we knew personally who would help. It was a fraught process, often requiring spending longer on the telephone than with the patient. A nerve-wracking experience when you were the only doctor in a small regional hospital emergency department, or casualty, as it was known then. This edition is the result of the hard work and dedication of our guest editor, Dr. Erica Musgrove. We first met Erica when she was a medical student during the chaos of the COVID-19 pandemic and the Vice President Internal of the Australian Medical Students Association, and we jointly organised an online webinar about patient safety and the communiques to an audience of more than 2,000 viewers. Following this, she coordinated and supervised the production of two special medical student-led episodes of the communiques podcast, in which an existing edition was revisited from a medical student lens. Erica completed this edition despite the incredible demands on her time and moving to work and undertake rural generalist training with the Australian College of Rural and Remote Medicine in the Northern Territory. Her attention to detail, organisation skills, and understanding of how the existing systems and processes influence an individual's ability to perform well was immediately evident. Erica is a country girl at heart, having grown up in Mildura, northwest Victoria, and a passionate rural doctor in training who enjoys all aspects of medicine, from primary to critical care. It was her desire for her colleagues to truly understand the challenges, but also to see the opportunities for growth and learning in rural medicine that led her to the case for this edition. When not at work or tending to extracurricular activities, she enjoys hiking, water skiing, yoga, board games, spending time with her partner, and their adopted greyhound, Boy.
Let's now listen to a description of our case report titled Midnight in the Outback.
Case: Midnight in the Outback by Dr. Erica Musgrove. Clinical summary: Miss FD was a 68-year-old woman with oculopharyngeal muscular dystrophy, a progressive condition that caused gradually worsening dysphagia. In February, her condition had progressed and she became unwell with aspiration pneumonia, necessitating an admission to her local rural hospital in Queensland for intravenous antibiotics. The day after admission, Miss FD was noted to regurgitate her food, prompting a discussion with the gastroenterology team at the nearest regional tertiary hospital. The same day, Miss FD was transferred to this regional hospital for further assessment of her dysphagia. The gastroenterology team determined that Miss FD required the insertion of a percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy tube, known as a PEG, for safe feeding. In the meantime, she was to be fed via a nasogastric tube, NGT. Whilst awaiting her PEG insertion, Miss FD was transferred back to her local rural hospital for ongoing NGT feeding. She was also continued on oral antibiotics, Augmentin, for her aspiration pneumonia. 4 days later, Miss FD was transferred again to the regional hospital and underwent an uncomplicated PEG tube insertion the next day. Feeding via the PEG tube commenced the same evening as insertion and was well tolerated. The following day, Miss FD and her daughter received education from a PEG-credentialed dietitian, were provided with a script for the PEG feeds and topical antibiotics for the PEG site, and Miss FD was discharged home. 5 hours later, Miss FD presented to her local rural hospital with nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, weakness, fevers, and rigors. On assessment, she was febrile, 39.1 degrees Celsius. Reference range, 36.0 to 37.9 degrees Celsius. Tachypneic and hypoxic. Her chest was clear and her abdomen was soft, although she had epigastric tenderness. Bloods were taken and the initial plan was to administer intravenous, IV, antibiotics. However, due to difficulties in obtaining IV access, Augmentin via her PEG tube was given instead. The next day, the nursing staff noted that Miss FD had significant pain on mobilising to the toilet. On routine observations, her blood pressure was 80 over 51 millimetres of mercury. The nurse rechecked her blood pressure and it improved to 92 over 54 millimetres of mercury. All her other vital signs were normal at this time. The nurse notified a doctor who made no further orders. Late that afternoon, Miss FD was seen by a senior medical officer, SMO, who made no changes and advised the nurses to continue Miss FD's current plan of antibiotics via the PEG tube and ongoing PEG feeds. That evening, nursing staff noted that Miss FD had worsening lower abdominal pain, deteriorating oxygen saturation levels, saturations of 94% down from 98% on room air earlier that day, and borderline hypotension, 99 over 53 millimetres of mercury. The next day, Miss FD was seen by an SMO in the morning, who advised the nursing staff to continue the current management and repeat blood tests. The plan was to contact the gastroenterology team at the regional hospital if her inflammatory markers were elevated. Miss FD was seen again by the medical registrar at midday, who noted that she did not have generalised abdominal pain. Rather, there was pain localised around the PEG site, and this had been worsening since her re-presentation to the local hospital. The registrar also noted that Miss FD had umbilical tenderness on examination. The blood test results from that morning returned, showing a white cell count of 3.5 times 10 to the power of 9 per litre. Reference range 4.5 to 11.0 times 10 to the power of 9 per litre. But a markedly elevated CRP of 346 milligrams per litre. Reference range less than 5 milligrams per litre. Shortly after Miss FD was given her PEG feed at 4 p.m, she was noted to be coughing and vomiting, and the PEG feed was leaking extensively. This triggered a review by the SMO, who noted generalised abdominal distension and tenderness, and reviewed the CRP result. The rural hospital team then contacted the regional gastroenterology team, and an urgent CT and PEGogram was ordered. A short time later, the CT scan was verbally reported to the treating team as copious intraperitoneal fluid with gas, clinical impression of peritoneal leak from PEG. Miss FD was commenced on IV ceftriaxone, and the SMO contacted the tertiary hospital surgical team for an urgent transfer. By 8:30 p.m, Miss FD had developed an acute kidney injury, hepatic injury, and an elevated lactate, and was becoming more unwell with increasing tachypnea, hypoxia, and hypothermia. Another antibiotic, metronidazole, was administered intravenously. By the time the Queensland Ambulance Service arrived, Miss FD had a respiratory rate of 30, a heart rate of 112 beats per minute, and oxygen saturations of 88%. Miss FD was loaded into the ambulance with a nurse escort, a paramedic, and her daughter. The ambulance left the rural hospital at 10:15 p.m. During the transfer, the nurse escort noted that Miss FD's hypoxia was worsening. At 10:34 p.m, the paramedic phoned the operations centre and advised they may need a critical care paramedic if Miss FD's condition deteriorated further. Shortly after this, Miss FD's saturations dropped to 79 to 80%, despite being given 15 litres of oxygen via a non-rebreather mask, and she was tachypneic and hypotensive. The paramedic decided to divert to another nearby rural hospital for medical assistance and informed the operations centre at 10:46 p.m. that Miss FD's condition had deteriorated. The doctor at the nearby rural hospital contacted Retrieval Services Queensland, RSQ, for advice. By this stage, Miss FD was tachycardic, diaphoretic, had increased work of breathing, and a reduced conscious state. There was purulent discharge draining from the PEG site. Both the doctor and RSQ realised that Miss FD was critically unwell and that there was little more that could be done at this rural hospital. Retrieval Services Queensland instructed the nurse escort on how to commence a metaraminol infusion to support Miss FD's blood pressure if required for the remainder of the transfer. The ambulance recommenced the transfer at 11:44 p.m. and the paramedic requested Queensland Ambulance Service backup for the rest of the transfer. A few minutes later, while the nurse escort was drawing up the metaraminol infusion, Miss FD went into a cardiopulmonary arrest. Basic life support and cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, were commenced, and the ambulance returned to the nearby rural hospital. However, Miss FD was declared deceased at 1 a.m. Pathology. Miss FD's case was reported to the coroner due to concerns that she may have died from a healthcare-related complication. The autopsy revealed Miss FD's cause of death to be sepsis from peritonitis due to a leaking PEG tube. Investigation. The coroner's investigation incorporated an independent clinical review of Miss FD's case by a specialist in forensic medicine and a root cause analysis, RCA, conducted by the healthcare network in which Miss FD died. The RCA included representatives from Queensland Ambulance Service and Retrieval Services Queensland, who had not been involved in Miss FD's care. In reviewing Miss FD's case, the coroner made note of a few key issues relating to her care. 1. The delays in recognising and treating Miss FD's sepsis and the failure to consider intra-abdominal sepsis as a potential source given her recent PEG insertion. 2. The lack of familiarity of local rural hospital staff with PEG tube management and its potential complications. 3. The appropriateness of the chosen mode of transfer for Ms. FD when she was critically unwell. Recognition of sepsis. When Ms. FD re-presented to her local rural ED following her PEG tube insertion, she met several sepsis criteria, including an initial blood lactate level of 2.98, reference range less than 2 millimoles per litre. Despite this, no blood cultures were taken, and the after-hours pathology service was not activated to run other blood tests as a matter of urgency overnight. Furthermore, due to the difficulties in obtaining IV access, there was a 6-hour delay before Ms. FD received antibiotics via her PEG tube. Ms. FD's blood specimens were analysed the following morning. However, it is unclear from the records if the treating team had seen or reviewed the blood results, which revealed an elevated white cell count of 18.6 times 10 to the power of 9 per litre. Reference range 4.5 to 11 times 10 to the power of 9 per litre. Neutrophils of 16 times 10 to the power of 9 per litre. Reference range 2.5 to 7.0 times 10 to the power of 9 per litre. And a CRP of 36 milligrams per litre. Reference range less than 5 milligrams per litre. Her chest X-ray had improved compared to the previous images from her initial admission in February with aspiration pneumonia. Despite the improvements on X-ray, the treating team continued to assume that the source of Ms. FD's sepsis was a recurrence of her aspiration pneumonia, rather than considering a potential intra-abdominal source of sepsis given her recent PEG tube insertion. When Ms. FD's blood pressure dropped to 80 over 51 millimetres of mercury on her first day of admission, it should have automatically triggered an emergency response call as per the hospital's protocol. Instead, the blood pressure was rechecked and a doctor was advised. This doctor did not make any further orders despite the fact that Ms. FD was usually hypertensive, meaning this was a significant drop from her baseline blood pressure readings. PEG management and complications. The staff at the local rural hospital were unfamiliar with PEG care and potential complications in the first few weeks after insertion. The PEG clinical resources available to them did not highlight when to suspect complications, how to manage complications, or who to contact out of hours for PEG-related concerns. As such, the position of Ms. FD's PEG tube bumper, which was noted to be at a 4-centimetre marking on insertion at the regional hospital, was not measured or documented when she re-presented to the local rural hospital. Moreover, PEG feeds were continued via the tube without confirming its position, despite her new and worsening abdominal pain and deteriorating vital signs. Delays and issues of transfer. In addition to the delays in recognising Ms. FD's sepsis, there was a further delay as the surgical registrar at the regional hospital initially declined to accept the transfer when first contacted at 6:30 p.m. The registrar said a formally documented CT report by the radiologist was required before accepting the transfer, despite the treating team relaying the verbal report suggesting a leaking PEG tube. The formal CT report was completed at 7 p.m, which confirmed the diagnosis. At 8 p.m, the SMO tried to call the surgical team again, who were busy in theatre, and said they would call back when able. Eventually, the oncoming night SMO ended up contacting the regional hospital's ED consultant as a last resort, who accepted the transfer immediately. By the time the treating team recognised Ms. FD's sepsis and her need for transfer, she was rapidly deteriorating. Despite this, her case was not discussed with Retrieval Services Queensland, the usual transfer service of choice for critically unwell patients. Instead, a request was made for a Queensland Ambulance Service road transfer. The request was made for a nurse-only escort, and the reason for transfer was stated as needs urgent surgical review for dislodged PEG, free air and fluid in abdo on CT. Consequently, Miss FD was transferred by a single paramedic, a nurse with only basic life support training, and her daughter. At the second rural hospital en route, where the paramedics stopped to receive help, the doctor could not leave their post as there was no second on call, and they could only provide basic life support as there was no GP anaesthetist available. Although the doctor did call Retrieval Services Queensland, waiting for their helicopter to retrieve Miss FD would have taken longer than continuing the 50-minute drive to the regional hospital. Hence, the decision was made to proceed with the road transfer with the recognition that there was a high chance that Miss FD would deteriorate further. Upon recommencement of the transfer, the paramedic called to request Queensland Ambulance Service backup for the remainder of the transfer due to Miss FD's critical condition. However, there was a miscommunication at the operation centre, and this request was not actioned, so no backup crew was ever dispatched. Finally, when Miss FD arrested, the nurse, paramedic, and Miss FD's daughter commenced CPR and basic life support management, but Miss FD remained in a non-shockable rhythm. After 10 minutes of roadside CPR and without any backup in sight, the paramedic decided to return to the nearby rural hospital. At the hospital, resuscitation continued for a further 20 minutes. However, efforts were ceased after discussion with Miss FD's daughter, and Miss FD died at 1 a.m. Coroner's findings. Recognition of sepsis. The coroner concluded that there were multiple points at which the local rural hospital failed to recognise and treat Miss FD's sepsis. It was also noted that there should have been higher clinical suspicion for intra-abdominal sepsis given Miss FD's recent PEG insertion, rather than treating based on the assumption that it was a continuation or recurrence of her aspiration pneumonia. Notably, following Miss FD's death, the local rural hospital adopted and implemented the Rural and Remote Sepsis Pathway, which aids clinicians to quickly recognise patients who have risk factors for sepsis and or those who meet sepsis criteria. This pathway is part of the larger adult sepsis pathways developed by the Queensland Sepsis Collaborative, which also provides management advice for treating sepsis, including region-specific antimicrobial guidelines. PEG management and complications. The absence of appropriate clinical guidelines about PEG complications was determined to be a root cause in Miss FD's case. Ultimately, the coroner concluded that earlier recognition of Miss FD's sepsis, earlier discussion with the regional gastroenterology team, and earlier transfer may have altered her outcome. Delays and issues of transfer. The coroner also commented on the safety and appropriateness of Miss FD's transfer, given her clinical deterioration. Acknowledging that it may not have altered the chosen transfer method, the coroner concluded that consideration should have been given to discussing her transfer with Retrieval Services Queensland. Additionally, despite the rollout of a Safe to Send campaign just prior to Miss FD's death, a Safe to Send checklist was not completed. Utilisation of the Safe to Send principles would have encouraged staff to recognise that Miss FD was so unwell that she should have been transferred with a medical officer escort. Author's comments. A key reflection from reading Miss FD's case is the importance of focusing on the basics of clinical assessment and harnessing your clinical acumen. In rural healthcare, you often have to make clinical decisions with only very basic diagnostic tests available. Even so, if you consider Miss FD's initial examination findings when she presented to ED and her lactate level of 2.98 millimoles per litre, which is easily obtained from an iStat machine, even if formal blood test results are not available, there is enough to indicate a potentially unwell and/or septic patient. Moreover, as pointed out by the coroner, the fact that Miss FD had had a recent PEG insertion should have raised alarm bells in the doctor's mind that this could be intra-abdominal sepsis and appropriate management instituted. The importance of early sepsis identification and management has been comprehensively addressed in previous Future Leaders Communique editions. See FLC Volume 3, Issue 4 October 2018. FLC Volume 4, Issue 3, July 2019. FLC Volume 7, Issue 2, April 2022. In this edition, I chose to focus on the rural setting and the issues that arose from the geographical context. An issue that stood out for me was the interaction and discussion between the local rural hospital staff and the surgical registrar from the specialist centre. Doctors in training, especially registrars, are often the initial point of contact for the rural doctors or nurses requesting to transfer a patient for further and/or subspecialist care. When I have heard registrars taking these calls, often they seem to assume or conclude that rural doctors are simply not as good as the ones in their hospital, without appreciating the challenges and limitations rural-based practitioners face. In Ms. FD's case, the surgical registrar, almost certainly unintentionally, delayed accepting the transfer by asking and waiting for the formal CT scan report, even though the patient was increasingly unwell and the verbal CT report suggested a PEG complication. Even if Ms. FD was not critically unwell, a transfer was reasonable as it may be requested for a relatively stable patient in some cases because the local medical service cannot provide the care should a clinical deterioration occur. For example, many rural hospitals do not have an obstetric service, a high dependency or intensive care unit, or staff trained to work in these areas. Thus, even if an individual practitioner has the necessary skill set, it is much safer to transfer a patient at risk of deterioration earlier rather than transporting a patient after they have become critically unwell. For city receivers, you must not make assumptions. You should refrain from belittling doctors calling you for help. Instead, take the time to understand their local context and what they are working with. On the other hand, as the saying in rural medicine goes, if you have seen one rural town, you have seen one rural town. Emphasizing that every single rural, regional, and remote site is different. Thus, rural doctors calling for help need to clearly outline their specific setting and what resources they do or do not have, rather than assuming the person on the other end of the phone knows what you are dealing with. Ms. FD's case underscores the importance of clear, cooperative discussions and mutual understanding between rural and regional or city doctors to facilitate high quality, timely, and ultimately, safe patient care.
Let's now listen to our two expert commentaries. The first is titled Navigating Systems and Pathways by Dr. Simon Judkins, who is the Director of Emergency Medicine at Echuca Regional Health in Victoria and a past president of the Australasian College for Emergency Medicine. The second commentary is titled A Junior Doctor's Guide to Retrieval by Dr. Bridget Honan, who is a VMO consultant for the Medical Retrieval and Consultation Centre in Alice Springs, Northern Territory.
Expert Commentary 1. Navigating Systems and Pathways by Dr. Simon Judkins. It's every new doctor's moment of truth. Congratulations on your employment at St. Royal's Centre of Excellence. Now your first role with us will be a three-month rotation at one of our rural facilities, No Bells or Whistles Regional Hospital. It's just 300 kilometres northwest of here. Oh, and you'll be starting on night shifts. That includes covering the ED and the wards. But don't worry, there is an on-call SMO about 30 minutes away, depending on the roads. So all should be okay. As a senior clinician who moved to a sub-regional facility, taking on a role away from all the comforts of a big tertiary ED, I must admit I was a bit nervous. Although I had been in the game for over 20 years, moving to a smaller facility with a community which has the similar healthcare needs, if not more varied and complex, but without the infrastructure, resources, or financial clout to deliver what is possible in a much better resourced urban environment, was a daunting challenge. So, as a new kid in town, the challenges for a less experienced junior doctor are tenfold. Having spent the last few years trying to get through the study and exams, moving out of your comfort zone as a junior doctor can be overwhelming. Much less doing this in an unfamiliar place and away from your usual support networks. However, in a well-supported rural facility, this time can be rewarding and a positive learning experience, where you get to put your accumulated knowledge to the test and, with good clinical leaders, make a meaningful contribution. Some of the most significant challenges in medicine, but particularly in rural settings, is learning about systems. It is about recognizing unwell patients and knowing how to escalate care when needed. Sometimes, that is realizing that the hospital you are in does not have the capacity to provide a higher level of care, so a patient needs to be transferred. Knowing how to get that done through escalating concerns, so-called graded escalation, is a skill which is hard to practice. The reality is almost always different to the rehearsal, but practicing these critical scenarios is pivotal to understanding when things go wrong and how to get the language right and engage people who can offer solutions. This is an issue which should be discussed in your orientation as a junior doctor starting at any new hospital, and if it isn't, you should be asking for it. It is essential that you know where to go for help, who to escalate to, who will support you and guide you through a difficult situation. This is a process that all rural facilities and their staff need to have embedded in their DNA. And what about the receiving end? Is there a lack of understanding and appreciation from our urban cousins about what can be delivered at a local level? In my experience, this is not uncommon and seems to reoccur every time staff rotate. Often new, previously unacquainted clinicians are having critical conversations at 3 a.m, all trying to do the right thing, all worried about making a wrong call and not keen to wake their new boss with a seemingly simple question such as, should I arrange a transfer? Or calling the visiting medical officer asking, can you come in? Or being the registrar at the receiving end wondering, should I accept a transfer? Should I wake my boss to discuss it? Establishing clear pathways is key, as is involving senior clinicians who have a more established understanding of risks and benefits and who can guide their less experienced team members on how to navigate difficult decisions. It makes these conundrums easier to manage. This needs to start with conversations at senior levels, directors of medical services, chief medical officers, and unit directors need to work through these scenarios, unpack the barriers, and build a pathway which, unless there is a good reason to deviate, any deviation is the exception. There is no doubt that there are other issues which will have impacted in this case. A surgical registrar who may have been stuck in theatre for long hours, handing over second-hand information, waiting for acceptance of transfer rather than just arranging transfer of a sick patient. Diagnostic momentum. It all plays a part. In reflecting on this case, it is interesting to think about the possible contrasts in care and outcomes. What would have happened if this patient had presented to the same centre where she had her procedure? I imagine she would have been, or should have been, treated as a failed discharge and readmitted back under the team who had looked after her initially. She would have had a review by the team who did the procedure to ensure that her representation was, or was not, related to that procedure, and she probably would have been able to access a CT scan and surgical review in a timely manner. Hopefully, the warning signs of sepsis would have been picked up earlier, although that can't be guaranteed. But we don't know any of this for sure. We just assume this should be the process. The key point here for junior doctors and others working in difficult circumstances is that the systems we work in are not perfect. We need to continue to identify why issues like those presented in this case reoccur. And we know that the answers are not sitting with individuals. The answers lie in developing a systems approach to risk identification, risk mitigation, and communication of these strategies. Assuming that systems work will always lead to failed assumptions and, therefore, poor patient outcomes. Expert Commentary 2. A Junior Doctor's Guide to Retrieval. By Dr. Bridget Honan, who is a VMO consultant for the Medical Retrieval and Consultation Centre, Alice Springs, Northern Territory. As a junior doctor in a rural hospital, you may be tasked with organising patient transfers. Emergency inter-hospital transfers are often essential for accessing advanced diagnostic facilities, specialised staff, and critical care expertise. In this case, the patient required urgent surgery and ICU support due to septic shock and multi-organ failure from a surgical complication. However, the urgency to move the patient towards surgery led to a compromise in stabilization efforts prior to transfer. This dilemma, balancing immediate transport with adequate stabilization, is often framed as stay in play versus scoop and run. Historically, transfers from rural areas were managed in a haphazard manner with varying degrees of consistency and safety. Today, we have more structured retrieval systems to ensure that critical transfers are handled more effectively. Ideally, modern retrieval systems streamline the process. One phone call to a retrieval coordinator sets everything in motion. This coordinator manages the logistics of the transfer, including decisions about urgency, resource allocation, crew composition, and transport mode. Fixed wing, rotary, or road. They use detailed information from the referring hospital, sometimes including video links, to make these decisions, aiming for the right patient, right team, right platform, right place, right time. One of the tenets of mature retrieval systems is that patients should always be moving up the chain of care, meaning that the level of care provided during transport should aim to at least equal that at the point of referral. While it can be challenging to manage a critically ill patient in a rural hospital, most facilities have access to a team of doctors and nurses, a resuscitation space, and treatment options like breathing and circulatory support. Utilizing the resources available to you is often preferable to dispatching the patient into a setting with less staffing and resources. A consensus guideline for the transport of critically ill patients has been endorsed by Australian and New Zealand College of Anaesthetists, Australian College of Emergency Medicine, and College of Intensive Care Medicine. See list of resources, item 1. This guideline recommends that inter-facility transport of critically ill patients should be performed by qualified retrieval teams that include an experienced doctor. Furthermore, where feasible, stabilization should occur prior to transport. The only exception to this is if stabilization can occur only with treatment available at the receiving facility, example, traumatic hemorrhage. Preparation prior to departure involves anticipating potential deterioration and planning for managing any complications. For example, in a patient with sepsis, the referring team can anticipate that the patient might need increasing oxygen and blood pressure support. Communication should involve a structured handover between the referring and receiving teams. Using a checklist can be helpful to ensure nothing is missed. The New South Wales Emergency Care Institute has recently published resources to support clinicians organising retrieval or urgent inter-hospital care. In the handover and advice for adult patient needing transfer document, they have a checklist that prompts referrers to review the patient's airway, breathing, circulation, disability, exposure, lines, investigations, micro and other communication. Here's how you, as a rural junior doctor, can navigate the retrieval process effectively. Understand your referral pathway. Know whether your facility uses a single statewide retrieval service or if you need to contact your local base directly. Be aware of any distinctions for adult, pediatric, or neonatal services. Prioritize safety. The quickest route isn't always the safest. Ensure that the patient is as stable as possible before initiating the transfer. Communicate effectively. Stay in close contact with the retrieval coordinator and use a structured approach for handover. Advocate for your patient if the coordinator seems unfamiliar with local resources or conditions. In summary, while our retrieval systems aren't perfect, understanding how they work and how to effectively use them can make a big difference in patient care. By recognizing and addressing gaps in the system, we can improve outcomes and ensure that our patients receive the best possible care, even in challenging situations.
The final section includes the reflections of other doctors in training about the case and expert commentaries.
Comments from our peers. Having been trained to practice in a major metropolitan health service, my first secondment in a small regional hospital was a daunting but ultimately invaluable experience as a junior doctor. When practicing in a setting where external diagnostic tools may not be readily available, and with the nearest referral centre potentially hours away, developing keen clinical skills and the ability to appropriately escalate and advocate for patients while understanding the ceilings of care available at a health service becomes essential. For junior doctors, early recognition of high-risk features for rapid deterioration of our patients, such as the clinical signs of developing or early sepsis, offer the opportunity for early intervention and escalation. A mutual respect and understanding between clinicians across health services underlies the ability to openly and clearly communicate to ensure safe management, transport, and handover of unwell patients. Health services can empower their junior doctors with orientation around clear referral pathways, availability of senior support when required, and cooperative team-based care across wider health networks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode. Remember, the online print versions are available at our website, www.thecommuniques.com, which also includes a list of the recommended resources and references. We also have an extensive podcast catalogue of previous editions for the Future Leaders Communique, along with our sister publications, the Clinical Communique and the Residential Aged Care Communique. These are available and free to download through our website or via Spotify, Apple, and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.